Well, good morning. Before we call our first case for today, my notes tell me that we have Monticello High School students and their advisors visiting us, and if they are here, would they stand, please? Oh, very nice. Well, thank you very much. You may be seated. The students are here with a program called Court with Class that the Supreme Court operates in connection with the State Bar of Wisconsin. And they receive some materials about the case. And then at the break at lunchtime, after our second case, one of the justices will come and speak with them. Today, it's going to be Justice Abrahamson. She sits on my right here, and she'll meet with you and talk not about the case in particular in regard to the merits, but more about how the Supreme Court operates and fits in with our other courts. Now, I've introduced Justice Abrahamson, and you've stood up for us. I'd like to introduce the rest of the members of the court. On my far right, Justice Michael Gabelman. Next to him, Justice David Prosser. And I've already introduced Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I'm Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left is Justice Annette Ziegler. And on the far left is Justice Rebecca Bradley. With all those introductions, we are now ready to call the first case for the morning. Okay, Singh versus Kemper, 13 AP 1724. Are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. I don't have a computer today for some reason, and I don't have any papers. I just need some paper. Thank you. Please begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Philip Abler, a Foley & Lerner, on behalf of Amon Singh. May I please report? This case looks complicated, but it's actually simple at heart. The legislature cannot constitutionally increase punishments after the fact. In 2009, the legislature gave the right to early release to several classes of inmates and provided other opportunities for discretionary release to others. When the legislature in 2011 tried to retroactively take that right away, it increased punishments.
You know, Mr. Babler, you use the phrase after the fact. The legislature cannot increase the sentence after the fact. What specific event are you referring to as the fact? Because, as you know, that is a point of contention in this case.
The legislature cannot increase a sentence either after a crime has been committed or after an individual pleads guilty and is sentenced under a certain sentencing scheme.
Well, it seems that there's a fairly long line of case law in regard to the increase or purported increase of a sentence after the commission, after its commission. But I wonder what you rely on for the idea it can't be extended after the sentence. There's a long line of case law that your opposing counsel points us to say that the relevant point of action, the fact, is the date of commission. Why is that not true?
Well, it is true. In most cases, there is no meaningful distinction between the sentencing the penalty at the time a crime is committed and the penalty when someone is sentenced. This is a rare situation.
In most cases, there probably won't be a two-year interim between the two either. So what are we looking at here?
In most cases, the issue never arises. But there are cases that mention the time of sentencing as a relevant time period. For example, Mueller versus Powers talks about a penalty being increased after an individual is sentenced. Eder v. Matthews says the same thing. Weaver v. Graham talks about the importance of opportunities for positive adjustment time or opportunities for early release as factoring into a sentence or factoring into a plea. When an individual pleads guilty, the penalty they're facing is relevant. So Weaver versus Graham also talked about the importance in plea negotiations of the right to early release.
Okay, thank you.
And there are also other cases as a matter of Wisconsin statutory interpretation. Once a law is repealed, it's gone. So the only way to bring back the former system is to pass a new law. And that new law, if it's passed after the fact and increases punishments, it violates the ex post facto clauses.
I did not review for today's hearing the case of Pew versus United States or Garner versus Jones. Those cases are cited in paragraph 9 of the Court of Appeals opinion, but with a C cite, you know, S-E-E cite, those two cases. And they are cited for this proposition that the question is whether a change in the law creates a significant risk of prolonging a prisoner's incarceration beyond what it would have been under the law in effect at the time of the prisoner, at the time the prisoner committed or was convicted. So that goes to Justice Gableman's question, but I, as I say, I haven't reviewed those cases, and it is a C cite. Do those cases stand for the proposition, if you know, that both commitment, excuse me, both the commission of the crime as well or was convicted and sentenced on the offense, those are also triggering times?
Those cases don't relate to the specific convicted and sentenced point. The key cases for the convicted and sentenced point are Mueller versus Powers, Eder versus Matthews, and Weaver versus Graham, as well as the Wisconsin statutory interpretation cases I cited. Garner versus Jones and Pugh versus United States stand for a different proposition, and that proposition is also relevant in this case. They relate to the role that discretion plays in the ex post facto analysis. The warden argues that the presence of discretion before and after suggests that there could be no ex post facto violation. But Garner versus Jones itself says the presence of discretion does not displace the protections of the ex post facto clause. And Pugh versus United States stands for the same proposition. That case is about sentencing guidelines in federal court. The actual range of penalty didn't change under the scheme in Pugh versus United States, but there was certain factors guiding a district court's discretion in imposing a sentence. And when that sentence or when that discretionary standard changed from a lower standard to a higher standard, it violated the ex post facto clauses. Pugh said common sense suggests that this change in discretion, it was cabined in a certain circumstance and it changed, that would increase punishments, and therefore that change violated the ex post facto clauses. So those cases are relevant to the case, but not on the specific convicted and sentenced point.
Counsel, can you walk me through a little bit the timeline here and what your argument means for Mr. Singh, if you prevail? There was a case where a complaint was filed in December of 2008 in Waukesha County, right?
Yes.
The information was filed in August of 2009 in Waukesha County on that same case. He ended up being convicted and sentenced, that I use that term loosely, in that he received probation, right?
He was sentenced to prison time, and the prison sentence was stayed, and probation was placed instead. Correct, Your Honor.
All right. And then there was a second offense in Milwaukee County where the complaint was filed in August of 2011. And the issue revolves around his 2008 case primarily, right? What they can do with that sentence, and whether he should have PAT on that?
He was seeking a positive adjustment time on both. The sentences were served consecutively, so he was seeking positive adjustment time for both of those convictions, the Waukesha County case and the Milwaukee County case.
What was the repeal date for PAT?
It was August 3rd of 2011, which was after Mr. Singh committed the the Milwaukee County offense.
Okay.
So when he committed
that.
But
the complaint was filed after the date of repeal.
It may have been. But when the date of commission was while positive adjustment time was in effect.
So that's why Justice Bradley and Justice Gableman's questions have more bearing, because you're going under the theory it's the date of commission of the offense?
It applies to either, Your Honor. Mr. Singh's position is that ex post facto analysis is relevant based on the date of commission, which applies to the Milwaukee County case. And it's also relevant if an individual pleads guilty and is sentenced under a scheme that includes early release, and that's later changed. Ex post facto is relevant to that as well. That's the Waukesha County case.
Okay.
So that's...
And these were consecutive to each other. So what is it your contention that he deserves? What does he really get?
So for positive adjustment time, there were multiple opportunities for early release that were part of the 2009 Act. But for positive adjustment time, I think the total sentence was 3.5 years, 18 months on the first. This is the confinement portion of prison. There was also, I think, 4 years of extended supervision. But there was the 18 months of confinement for the first sentence, the 2 years of confinement for the second sentence, and so then it would be up to a third of that time for positive adjustment time, 1 day for 2 days earned. So he could have earned up to 14 months of positive adjustment time based on those two convictions.
Do you subtract that from each sentence? I mean, are you taking time off, positive adjustment time off from each of the sentences?
Under the statute, the consecutive sentences are treated as a single sentence. So it appears that an individual would earn positive adjustment time throughout the 3.5 year period, and the time would be taken off of the whole. So after 2 years and 4 months, the individual would be entitled to release if he had earned sufficient positive adjustment time. If that person obeyed the prison rules and did all assigned duties, they could earn positive adjustment time across the whole sentence and then be released 14 months early.
Now, if what are you asking for as a remedy if we agree with your position?
So you're asking for there's the two pieces of this. There's the whether positive adjustment time could be repealed in the first place, where the Court of Appeals correctly held that it could not. Or cannot be repealed retroactively. So affirm the Court of Appeals on that issue. There's the separate issue about the timing of the actual release. So the 973-198 issue. We ask for reverse the Court of Appeals in part on that issue and then remand to the Circuit Court with an order that the writ of habeas corpus be issued and the Circuit Court consider what other equitable relief is warranted, if any.
Well, in regard to your request for relief, The sentence in the second conviction for Milwaukee County was 24 months and 36 months extended supervision. But at the same time, he was convicted of an offense that occurred after the effective date of 973.198, and it gave him exactly the same sentence concurrent with the one in Milwaukee County. So doesn't that just zero out the Milwaukee County conviction in regard to our concern about whether there was a violation?
It was concurrent with, I believe, any other sentence. So since the
It said it was concurrent with the second and the fourth offense. So, yeah. But the fourth offense, he just got 6 months in the House of Corrections. And both the third and the fourth offense were committed after 973-198. Became effective. And I guess I'm just trying to overlay practically sentence on sentence, and it seems to me that the matter that I thought most people talked a lot about was the crime that was committed July 25th, 2011, but the sentence on that is the same as the one that was convicted after the effective date of 973-198. So in my mind, they sort of zero out each other. You agree with that or not?
No, because the Waukesha County conviction was consecutive to the...
So the second conviction, the first one in Milwaukee County.
The 4004 Milwaukee County case.
Right.
And so there was a 3.5 year period of confinement that is a continuous period of confinement. So Mr. Singh would have been eligible to earn positive adjustment time during that 3.5-year period. If the post-positive adjustment time sentence were long enough and concurrent during those sentences, it could conceivably affect the analysis, but that doesn't happen here because the total length of sentence was 3.5 years. The fact that there is the other Milwaukee County conviction doesn't affect that analysis.
Why doesn't it affect it? He would have had to have been incarcerated on that conviction. And that one has no, the 973-198 has nothing to do with the sentence that is due. It can't be affected by PAT.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Your Honor?
Yeah, he essentially has four convictions. One in Waukesha County and three in Milwaukee County. Most people talked about the one in Waukesha County and then the first one in Milwaukee County because it was committed before the effective date of 973-198. But he had two more convictions, both of which were committed after the effective date of 973-198. And for one of those sentences, the sentence was concurrent to the first Milwaukee County conviction, but there was no ability to get PAT on that sentence. So in my mind, I don't know why that doesn't just zero out anything that could be going on with the first Milwaukee County conviction. That's what I need your help on sorting out. Am I making sense to you?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm
you.
Just pulling up the conviction sheet to make sure I'm accurately stating it.
Sure.
Maybe if I try to help with a possible hypothetical. Let's assume that before PAT was revoked, he was sentenced to 24 months plus 36 months.
Yes.
And then after PAT was revoked, he committed an offense and was sentenced to 24 months plus 36 ES.
Well, that's what
if they both were to run concurrent
right.
to each other. Do you still believe there's a remedy for the first? What would he get? In my opinion, he's going to serve that second sentence concurrent.
Right.
It's no different than if, for example, someone were sentenced to 6 months and then on the second charge sentenced to 2 years and they run concurrent. The 6 months still is less than the 2 years, and you're still going to serve the 2 years.
Right.
That's what
Justice,
right. Chief exactly. Justice Rogan-Sack mm-hmm. was getting at. So without the specifics, I mean, if you put it in terms of a hypothetical that happens to be one relevant to these facts, yeah. There's really no remedy there, right?
In that hypothetical, there's not. But that's not this case. The 2011 CF-4192 case, that's the one that happened after positive adjustment time was repealed, that sentence was imposed concurrent to any other sentence.
Right.
So that would have been concurrent to the Waukesha case as well.
And the other Milwaukee count.
Yes. So there's 3.5 years total, but the two-year period wasn't concurrent just to the end of the 3.5 years. It was concurrent to any other sentence. So there still is the ability to earn positive adjustment time throughout the sentences, and once that 2 years would have been served at the front end, after 2 years and 4 months, there still would have been enough positive adjustment time on the other Milwaukee County conviction and the Waukesha County conviction for Mr. Singh to be released.
Now, it's my understanding that Mr. Singh is not in confinement. He is not in prison, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
In fact, the court raised the question whether the case was moot, because this is a habeas corpus case, and the person has to be in prison, and the remedy is release, right?
Yes.
And the concept is that it is moot, because he is out. Is he still out?
He is, Your Honor.
Okay. So for purposes of what we're doing today, does it matter about the Waukesha and Milwaukee issues? I thought that the purpose of this was to decide, and I thought that the court limited the question, at least in the petition, limited your question to whether the 973 statute, the 2011 statute, is constitutional or violates the Constitution upon being retroactive, ex post facto, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So, is it or isn't it violative of the Constitution, and why?
The 973-198 statute is also unconstitutional because it adds...
What do you mean also? Also to what?
Also, in addition to... So the legislature repealed the right to earn positive adjustment time throughout the full period of a sentence. The Court of Appeals correctly held that was unconstitutional. The 973-198 statute also is unconstitutional because it also increases sentences for individuals who have earned positive adjustment time. Because it adds 90 days, up to 90 days, to the end of a sentence. Under Wisconsin statute 302.113 sub 2 B and C, this is the 2009-2010 version, an inmate was released when he had served enough term of confinement and had earned enough positive adjustment time to equal his original confinement sentence. And there was a process that began 90 days before he would be released, so that he could be released on time. Under 973-198, a person cannot file a petition for positive adjustment time with the circuit court until that date when he would have been released anyways. So a person could lose up to 90 days of positive adjustment time earned.
Counsel, we've got a lot of assertions of violation of ex post facto, and I want law, and I want to better understand the interrelationship of them. The Court of Appeals found that there was a violation of ex post facto in the retroactive repeal. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that's what the state has contested in their cross petition for review. So there's one, the retroactive repeal is being asserted as violation of ex post facto. Then, with regard to 973-198, you are petitioning there's a violation of ex post facto, I guess, really, in two ways. Number one, the 90-day argument that is advanced, that is prior to the enactment of 973-198, request for early release, if I'm using the right term, was filed 90 days before the eligibility date. With the enactment of the statute, it now cannot be filed until the actual eligibility date. So you're saying that constitutes increased sentence of period of incarceration for up to 90 days. Your second argument under 973.198 is dealing with the standard of a review, I'll use that, the standard by which the court reviews it. So you've got three kicks at the cat. If we find it is a violation of ex post facto under one, how does that affect our need to proceed or find violation of ex post facto under the remaining two arguments advanced?
There's two cats. One is whether you can repeal it retroactively, and the other is the additional 90 days. So the court can decide them separately.
Why isn't it three cats? Because you have two arguments that compose the 973-198.
Either of the arguments for 973-198 is sufficient to strike the whole statute. But that's one of the two issues, whether that statute is a valid statute or not. And that's a separate issue from whether the legislature can take away the right to earn positive adjustment time throughout a sentence.
I understand it's a separate issue, but for purposes of us here today, I mean, it's a very separate issue.
Yeah.
But for purposes of us here today, need we, if we find a violation, let's say as the Court of Appeals did, do we need to address further the 973.198 argument you advance?
I think so,
but...
If the retroactive repeal is unconstitutional, that's a separate question, then Yeah, we also need to address the 973-198, whether that mechanism itself is constitutional for individuals who are trying to be released under positive adjustment time. And so there's the question of the right to earn it throughout your sentence, and then there also how you actually get out once you've earned positive adjustment time. So the court does need to address 973-198 in addition to the retroactive repeal of positive adjustment time and other rights to early release generally.
The Court of Appeals seems to say that your 973-198 argument only relates to procedure. It doesn't have anything to do with substance.
The focus below was on the standard that the court applied generally. And the question is whether there was a default that an individual be released or what standard the circuit court was applying. And the Court of Appeals didn't get into the 90-day addition. Yeah. 90 days of increased punishment is a procedure that increases a punishment. If you get out, you're supposed to get out on March 1st, but you don't get out.
I understand that, mm-hmm. But the Court of Appeals did not deal with that
issue. That's correct, Your Honor.
It dealt with the procedural issue involved as it saw it, and they thought it was wrong retroactive, that it was retroactive and violated ex post facto. You agree with that. That's what you want us to affirm. You want us to disagree with this procedural 973-198 that the Court of Appeals is set forth. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, my question comes to your reply brief. In your reply brief, you seem to say that the state has switched gears on Mr. Singh, that he came in under, and I'll probably get the numbers wrong, but that he came in under, what was it,
302-113-2B. Correct, Your Honor.
But that the state's argument proceeds under 304.061BG1.
Yes.
And that's not the statute. And the BG1 statute requires proof of a particular element, and that hasn't been proved in this case. So my simple way of trying to explain the brief. So what's the answer to all of that? And do you think it's a deliberate misstatement, or you think it's just a goof?
I don't know the reason for it, Your Honor. But I do know that under the terms of 302.113, it applied to nonviolent Class H felonies, which is what Mr. Singh committed. Habeas is an opportunity for the state to bring a person and show legal cause why he can constitutionally continue to hold that person. Nowhere has the warden demonstrated that the DOC did in fact determine Mr. Singh was ineligible under that procedure. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of that actually occurred anyplace. So if the state if the warden failed to put that in the record, the warden has certainly waived it, if it in fact even exists.
Thank you, counsel. Wait a minute. So what is 304.061BG1?
So that's a statute that applies to higher class felons or individuals who are formally determined to be more likely to reoffend.
Thank you. And is it clear that he doesn't fit within that? That there's nothing in the record that says he fits within that?
The warden never produced something to suggest that he was formally determined to be likely to reoffend.
So the question to be asked the state is he fits under 304.61BG1 or 302.113.2B. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of the question.
I want to know whether the state should therefore be asked under which provision he is.
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor.
Put in. Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Sarah Schaefer, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the state of Wisconsin. Justice Gableman, you asked at the beginning of this argument, what are we looking at? And that is the question that, when drafting this decision, as Justice Bradley said, there are three kicks of the cat. There are three ex post facto claims. Now, no matter how the court decides those claims, the state is here today seeking clarity, and it's seeking clarity on the issue. What is the relevant time period that courts look at when examining ex post facto laws? So when you write this decision, I think it would be beneficial for the parties to first say, this is the test. Is the test what this court has consistently said in Kurzawa and the U.S. Supreme Court has consistently said? Do you look at laws that have been changed that increase the punishment from when the crime was committed? Or, like the Court of Appeals and Singh suggests, can you also look at laws that have increased the punishment from when a defendant is sentenced or convicted? And when you decide that issue, I think all this court has to do is go to its Kurzawa decision. Because in that decision, the court looked exactly at what is the time period. That was the issue in the court. What is the time period we look at? And not only did it address the relevant time period, it stated why it is the relevant time period. Briefly, it was Kurzawa at 180 with 2D at 513. A fundamental aspect of ex post analysis is its focus is on the change in the law relative to the time of the defendant's allegedly illegal behavior. Namely, persons have a right to fair warning of that conduct which will give rise to criminal penalties. This explains why ex post facto analysis is concerned with changes in the law relative to the time the defendant engaged in his allegedly illegal behavior.
So you're not asking us to consider the date of the charging document. Why not?
I'm not because...
If it's all about notice, why wouldn't that be the notice?
Because, Judge Your Honor, I think I haven't found an ex post facto case that says the notice is from when the complaint is filed. I've never run across a case that said that. All the cases I have come across is time of the commission of the crime.
But before I go with you on your journey into the issue you want us to decide, let me just try to clarify something from your perspective that I was trying to clarify with counsel. As I understand the facts of this case, this particular defendant received a probationary sentence in a Waukesha County case for which PAT should apply, and that probation was revoked, and he ended up having the imposed and stayed sentence of 18 months confinement plus 18 months extended supervision. Correct so far?
That's correct so far.
And PAT should apply to that.
That's what he's claiming. I don't think that's correct.
All right. Well, either way, that's an issue then.
Yep.
Then I'm trying to get at what that means in terms of Mr. Singh's case here and what we send that back for. There's a Milwaukee County case. He's revoked on December 13, 11, presumably to serve the 18-18, right?
Correct.
Okay. And then he is sentenced in Milwaukee a few days later, 12-19-11.
Yes.
Okay. In the Milwaukee County cases, there are three cases. But when cases run concurrent to each other, basically is you're being sentenced on all three, but really there's one time period that you're serving, right? So the time period in Milwaukee that he'd be serving the longest sentence on, right, when they're concurrent, you go to what's the longest one, would be 24 months confinement plus 36 months extended supervision, right? And that is not subject to PAT, right? Because that was both charged and sentenced after the revocation of PAT,
right?
So in this particular case, what we're really talking about, or I'm wondering, are we really talking about his revocation 6 days prior to his sentence in Milwaukee County, and his revocation meaning that he was going to serve 18 months confinement plus 18 months ES?
that's served first under truth in sentencing, and then when the 18 months is exhausted, PAT applies or not, the 24 months would kick in on the consecutive sentence in Milwaukee County, and then he would serve the ES on both, right?
Yes.
Okay. So what we're talking about is the difference between what should he have, under their argument, what should he have received or what should have been done differently with respect to that interaction between the 18 months and the 24 months, right?
I think that's, yes.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I had that in my mind correctly because I wasn't hearing counsel's argument track with the way I understand sentencing structures to work, or at least the ones that I've done. Thanks.
Before the...
I'm sorry, but it's not the state's position that he should be sent back to confinement,
no,
is it?
No, no, no.
So he's out.
He's out.
The end, right?
Yes.
So what's the issue before this court?
Well, the issue in front of this court is, did the repeal of the 2011 Act, did it violate the ex post facto?
Okay, so did the 2011 Act violate ex post facto?
Right. And his claims are, does the specific statute 973-198, does that also violate the ex post facto clause? I did want to bring up before anything else concerning his Waukesha conviction. He has amended that sentence. So any claim that he has under his Waukesha case that he should receive PAT is out the window, and this is why. Mr. Singh is a prolific filer, and we have 3 pending cases with him right now. Last week, an attorney told me, well, in this Waukesha County case, he moved to have his sentence amended. I checked CCAP, it's a matter of public record, in his Waukesha County case, on 7/14/2015, the court granted the motion to have state sentence modified to 1 year jail time. And this is why this is important. You cannot get PAT for jail time. So any claim that he has of his Waukesha County claim that he should receive PAT for his Waukesha conviction is out the window because the sentence has been modified to jail time, and you can't receive PAT on jail
time. Okay, but he can modify it at this point in time when he's already served prison time on it and he's out? Are we talking about the same thing? I'm looking at the commission of the crime was October 16th, 2008. That's
yes.
The only Waukesha one I have.
Right, right.
Okay, and that's the one he got 18 and 18 on, months.
Right.
Okay, and he apparently served some time on it. I mean, the court gave him, 259 days of sentence
right.
credit on January 4th, 2012 when he began.
Right.
But now he's not, I don't understand.
I don't understand how he did it either.
Okay.
I don't have the case. All I know is that he was successful, and there is an amended sentence here.
Amended judgment of conviction on 7/14/2015. Is that what you're
talking
about?
That's correct, yeah. Right. And so now any claim that he should receive PAT under this conviction is out the window because he, for some reason, and I don't know why the court did it, but the court granted his...
His original petition asked us to deal with county jail time. We didn't take that
That's
case.
Correct. That's correct.
That's not before us. Whether county jail time
that's correct.
Deals with PAT,
right.
That's not before us.
Right, no, and that's my point because his claim was that under this sentence, under its original sentence, where it was 1.5 in, 1.5 out, he could get PAT. But now that he's had it modified, and now that it's modified to jail time, he can't get PAT.
Okay. We agree that he's out,
right?
And we agree that he doesn't, and according to the state, owe any more confinement time.
Right.
Right? Okay. So the defendant argues that this case should be sent back for equitable remedies. Right?
That's correct.
What are they, in your opinion?
I don't know what they are. I pointed that out to the court. I don't know. He doesn't suggest what they are. It's not.
I'm going to ask him that. When there's reply time,
okay.
A rebuttal time, I will ask, what are the equitable remedies?
Okay.
So we don't have to worry about the change in the in the sentencing for Waukesha.
Correct.
Okay.
Go ahead, David. I'm not sure I understood. The sentence was modified in Waukesha County?
Correct.
Was it modified after he served the sentence?
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't...
Well, if he... Can he make an argument that he served more time than the law permitted?
I don't think he can, under PA...
If he wins, if we buy his argument, okay, can he make an argument that he served more time than the law permitted?
I don't see how he can make that claim successfully. He never served a day in prison during the 2009 Act. And that was the point of my Court of Appeals argument, is he was never affected by the repeal of the 2011 Act because he never served a day in prison until January of 2012. And just to briefly address my main argument, the state's petition on appeal.
Counsel, I know that's where you really want to go. You started out this saying, hey, this is all about, take a look at the law from vis-a-vis when we start counting the time. And look at Kurzawa, and that's going to answer this case for us. That's how I understood your initial comment to be.
No, I'm sorry. What I want this court to do, I'm sorry, is before you get to the merits of the ex post facto claims, first tell us what it is. What is the relevant time period? So if the relevant time period is when the act is committed, arguably we could look at the Milwaukee commission of the crime, the 404 crime. That was committed during the time the PAT was allowed in the 2009 Act. So my argument is that regardless of that, the ex post facto cases that have concerned statutes similar to Wisconsin, where it's a discretionary, where PAT is discretionary, the Second Circuit and Supreme Court of Arkansas, where they examine statutes much like Wisconsin, they have determined that when a PAT is discretionary, all that is lost is an opportunity to receive good time, and that is separate and distinct from the other cases, from Weaver, from Lynn, where the automatic good time, it was automatic, it was mandatory.
That comes into play, and you cite Kurzawa in your brief on your cross-petition issue, but you don't cite it in your response brief on the 973-198 issue. Does that come into play on the 973 issue also?
The 973-1 issue, 973-981 issue, concerns basically the petitioner's claim that the sentencing court, the role of the sentencing court.
It has two components. Let me just get your response to something that's really bothering me, and that is the two components of the 973-198 claim. One is the review of the sentencing court. That's what the Court of Appeals dealt with.
Right.
But they led with their right, so to speak, in their brief. And they didn't start with the standards used by the sentencing judge. It was real simple. They said, look, ex post facto law prohibits the legislature from increasing the punishment for an offense after it has been committed. And 973-198 delays the PAT release for up to 90 days, and therefore there's a violation. Can you respond to that?
I can respond to that. I agree that there is the potential for delay under 973-198.
For up to 90 days?
I agree. When I was missing his argument, not to his fault. I thought he was arguing about the time that the court has to decide.
That's a 30-day thing. No,
right.
He's saying up to 90 days. You've got.
I think if you look at the statutes, I think that he's right, that there is a potential under the new statute that there could be a potential for a circuit court to delay up to 90 days. My argument to that is that does not make it unconstitutional. That does not make this procedural statute unconstitutional. Here's why. You look at Morales. In Morales, there were prisoners that could potentially be disadvantaged by not being able to apply for parole. No question, there could be defendants in this, inmates in this case, who could petition for PAT, and if a court sits on it, if the court sits on it for 90 days, they could lose some PAT time, up to 90, I'm sorry, the court could sit on it for up to 90 days.
The court could sit, are you talking about before the procedure was this, that 90 days
right.
before the eligibility date they were advised, they
right.
could, the court could have a hearing or could not have a hearing. If the court had a hearing, then the court would determine if eligible for PAT. If no hearing, then they automatically got PAT on the eligibility date. Automatically. And so why doesn't that, why aren't they right that there is up to 90 days more time under 973-198?
I think the focus for ex post facto is this 90 days. Does it increase his punishment? Does it increase his sentence? And my argument is that there is only a significant degree that under the new statute, that if a defendant applies for PAT, there is only a possibility that they could lose some of the PAT time that they apply for. And that's only if, in the extreme sentence, that the court takes the complete 60 days to decide and completes the 30 days, the extra 30 days, to release them. And the ex post facto clause looks at to whether it's a speculative or attenuated risk. And my response is sure, it could happen. I think reading the statutes, it could happen. But does that make it unconstitutional? And it's his burden to show that it is unconstitutional.
Under the change, 973-198, can it ever happen like it always did under the old law that they would be given the credit on eligibility date?
Yes.
It can't happen under the new law.
Yes.
Your opposing counsel says it doesn't happen. You need the 30 days, you need up to 60 days, so up to 90 days. That's the significant difference, as I read your opposing counsel. He can correct me.
If, for instance, if a petitioner applies for 100 days of PAT time, and he applies with under the new statute, and he applies with the sentencing court. The sentencing court has 60 days to make a determination, yes or no.
But he can't apply until the eligibility date. That's the point.
Well, he can apply to the eligibility date plus any PAT time he thinks he has earned.
Now, wait a minute. Suppose he thinks he has 90 days eligibility, right? When can he apply under the 2011 statute?
He can apply, so then he can apply 90 days before He can apply for that then.
Where is that in the statute? And while you're
okay.
looking it up, in other
97,
words...
Okay. When an inmate who is serving a sentence imposed under 973-01 and who has earned positive adjustment time under 302-113 or 304-16 and has served the confinement portion of his sentence, less positive adjustment time earned, he or she may petition the sentencing court to adjust the sentence. So you can petition after you've conserved your confinement time and you think you have PAT time, so if you think you have 90 days, you apply to the sentencing court 90 days before.
And therefore, the court will act, and if you lost no time. But if
right.
you wait till 75 days, even though you have 90, you will have lost.
That's correct. That could happen. That's
and
correct.
If you wait until the end of your confinement time and you don't take into account your PAT time, you can lose up to 90 days. Isn't that how it works?
That taken to the extreme, that could, if the court took all 90 days, yes, that could possibly happen. Is there evidence in this case that it happened? No. Did the petitioner come forward with evidence that this has ever happened? No. And this is a habeas case. And he was talking about the burdens earlier, and I think when this court talks about burdens, he doesn't dispute it's his burden to come forward to show that an ex post facto violation. But it's also his burden in a habeas case to come forward with facts and law to justify his claim that he is held in custody unconstitutionally. And he takes issue, issue with the warden for not presenting evidence at the habeas proceeding. It was never the warden's burden. It was always his burden.
Well, you expect then the prisoner to be in prison and calculate good time, that is his PAT, and then figure out when he should the initial application.
Correct.
You know, the problem with this case is it's moot. So talking about whether or not he shows that he was deprived of any time that it's unconstitutional doesn't work because he's out.
Correct.
When was he out? Before he brought habeas? While he brought habeas?
Well, I'm assuming he was in when he, well, he was at least in custody. He has to be in custody when he presented his habeas.
That's right. So after he brought the habeas, he was released.
Yes.
And we kept it anyway because he's within the group that could bring habeas and it would escape review if you didn't allow it.
That's correct. And also because the Court of Appeals struck down a state statute and it's Attorney General's job to, argue that state statutes are presumed constitutional. And
this is one of the things I don't understand about the Court of Appeals. They say that part of it is unconstitutional, and then they say part of it is constitutional. And they label the constitutional part procedures.
Yes.
Not the fact that you could, it's possible to lose up to 90 days.
Well, in the Court of Appeals, that was never brought to their attention. That issue was never brought to their attention.
Right,
so that's why they didn't address it. You guys are addressing it for the first time.
So you're not supporting the Court of Appeals in totality?
No.
What is it you want this court to do?
I want this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision that said the retroactive application of the 2011 law violates ex post facto.
Period.
Period. Because it's just a discretion, it's a discretion, PAT is discretionary. It is not a vested right. It is completely discretionary. It's an opportunity to be eligible. And then that eligibility, you have an opportunity to be granted. But it is not a vested right, and it does not.
What's not a vested right?
PAT is not a vested right.
Wasn't it vested in 2009?
No, it's always been discretionary. They have never disputed that. It was either in the discretion of the Department of Corrections or under the current law, it's in the discretion of the sentencing court.
So your position is that anything that's discretionary can't be vested?
No, I'm just saying in this case, the PAT, the courts that have looked at this exact issue, just the discretionary PAT, the opportunity, the possibility to earn it, is not enough to constitute a vested right.
So if you take away the opportunity or possibility, that would be taking away a vested right.
And could you repeat that? I want to be careful in my answer.
The 2009 gave the defendant an opportunity to get out early.
Correct.
The 2011 statute, according to you, still has an opportunity to get out early.
The 2011 statute completely eliminated PAT.
Okay. So the 2011 statute eliminated the possibility, the opportunity to get out early. So why isn't it a vested right to have an opportunity to get out early?
Because the Supreme Court has stated in Morales, and this court has followed Morales, that is not the correct inquiry. You do not look at whether someone is deprived an opportunity or is disadvantaged. There is no question that Mr. Singh is disadvantaged by this 2011 Act. He can no longer, or inmates like him, there's no question they are disadvantaged by it. But the Morales Court was specific in saying that is not what we look at anymore. The only thing you look at is does it increase petitioner's sentence.
Counsel, in order for me to understand where, if any place, PAT applies, I need to go over the sentences a little bit more. And I tried with opposing counsel, and I don't think we were really talking in a communicative way. You're saying that the only place that you look is at the date of commission of the crime to determine when you look at whether the law is ex post facto, right?
I am.
So on all of the convictions here, and there are four, the only one that's relevant is the July 25th, 2011 crime. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And that sentence was a sentence that was 24 months in, 36 out. And there was another sentence for a Milwaukee crime that had exactly the same sentence concurrent, 24 months in, 36 out. They began on the same day. So I don't, if I buy your argument that it's the date of commission, I don't see any place where PAT would have any effect on him at all, because he's got to serve the one 24 months in, 36 out, that resulted from the commission of a crime after the PAT was totally done away with.
And
Do you understand what's bothering me?
Right, and in all fairness, that didn't even cross my mind. I agree with you. I did not advance that argument. I do think you're correct, but I...
What effect does it have on your argument here?
That PAT would not, he can't even, the issue of PAT doesn't even apply to his 2011 crime that he committed.
So?
So therefore, and as I said, I did not think of this before. So because the 2008, because the Waukesha County conviction is out, and then because his Milwaukee was concurrent to his other Milwaukee case, that's out. So we can't claim PAT under any scenario.
But his Waukesha County case, it would have been possibly in play had he not amended it. The first 18 months.
I think she's saying it's not in play because it's the date of commission of the act, and he committed the act before PAT began.
Right.
He's done some other stuff now. I mean, you might not buy the argument.
If we don't buy that argument, though, because cases have referenced commission of the act or date of sentencing, right?
Mm-hmm. They have.
Then the 18 months would have been in play for a possible PAT consideration. But if I understand your argument correctly, one, it's not in play because it was amended. And two, it's not in play because it's tenuous. At best, that he would have even received PAT. At most, he was deprived of an opportunity to possibly have a consideration of whether he would receive PAT.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. But there still remains an issue whether he was deprived of PAT of other crimes? I mean, or is the whole thing gone? And we should just improvidently grant.
I don't know what other crimes he would be.
So does that mean there's nothing for us to decide in this case?
No, I do think this case has to decide, it has to decide basically, what is the relevant inquiry and, is he entitled to PAT under his Waukesha conviction?
Okay.
And is he entitled to PAT under his Milwaukee County conviction?
So it's the marker that we have to use, whether it's date of conviction, date of sentencing, or
commission of crime.
Right.
First, what is the relevant time period that the court looks at? And this court has never strayed. He cites Court of Appeals cases, but this court has never strayed that when you look at ex post facto, you look at the commission of the crime.
Are there any cases that deal with good time, before truth in sentencing, when you had the traditional prison sentence and someone automatically received good time? It's possible it could be fine-tuned by DOC, but they get good time. When truth in sentencing came into play, what happened to the good time analysis? Did people make the same argument?
I'm assuming that, you know, under that argument, it was mandatory, and so it would be a different argument here, whereas PAT is discretionary.
Are there any cases where people made that argument, though?
Not that I researched, Your Honor.
It is not clear to me what, if any, import this new amendment that you bring to the court's attention has today. I look at footnote 7 on page 28 of the brief of your opposing counsel on their issue, the 973 issue. And it says in part that, of course, we didn't take that issue, that is, what effect does jail time have with regard to the PAT. But it's stated more artfully here. It says, this court's decision on the ex post facto issues will leave unresolved whether the Court of Appeals was correct that individuals serving a portion of the prison sentence in jail are not entitled to good time credit under either the jail good time credit statute or the prison good time statute. And then they say, but compare this with State versus Harris, where inmates serving prison sentence in jail not entitled to good time credit under jail statute. And it goes on to say that this issue, whether or not if you're serving prison time in jail, you're entitled to good time under the prison statute. So what was it that got amended? Can you tell me?
What was that got amended? The 2011 Act?
Well, you said, hey, it was just amended last,
okay.
What was it? Was it the prison? was he serving prison sentence in jail, and that's what got amended?
It amended the sentence from, just have it.
Or don't you know?
From the 1.5 years, and it took away, so amended his sentence to jail time, and it took away his extended supervision.
Okay, that's not my question. He got rid of the extended supervision. Was the jail time serving prison time? Was the individual serving prison time in jail? That's what this footnote 7 raises as an issue.
Well, maybe we should just find the document.
Yeah, we find the document.
I'm sorry.
I have a question that relates to the reply brief of Mr. Singh relating to 302.113.2b and 304.061.bg1. You seem to have emphasized 304.061.bg, but the defendant says he falls under nonviolent class H felony under 302.113.2b, and you have to apply 2b, not 1BG1. What's your response to that?
His claim that he was eligible for release under 302 was simply that. It was a claim, and he had presented no evidence to habeas that he was eligible for it, whereas the state presented evidence to habeas that there was never an eligibility determination whether he was eligible for PAT. So I wasn't ready to concede that he was eligible under 302. But he stated in his brief that even if he wasn't eligible in 302, he could apply under 304, and I agree with that.
That was a footnote in his brief.
And so I agree with that. So I wasn't going to concede that he was eligible under 302, but I was ready to concede that if he wasn't eligible, he could still apply under 304.
So you're not really going – well, that confuses me. I understood that previously – if there was a notice 90 days before the eligibility date,
yes,
saying it's coming up, and an assertion of eligibility, if there was no determination made, in other words, the court didn't have a hearing, that the de facto result is that he got it, That's what I understood the old law to be. Is my understanding incorrect?
No, under the old law, he still had to apply for discretionary PAT. He still had to be eligible, and then he had to apply, and then there was the decision whether even it was granted. So he had to be eligible for PAT.
And if the court didn't hold a hearing to make such a determination, then what happened?
Well, then the DOC made the determination. So there would be a determination. In this case, we don't know. There's nothing in the record to suggest that he was eligible.
So what did the DOC do? I mean, wasn't there a 90-day under the old law? What was that 90-day thing? Where is that form?
The way this case happened was the DOC wrote a letter to the judge saying, listen, Mr. Singh has applied for PAT. Under our records, he is ineligible because he never served any time in prison during this time. So we don't think he's eligible for PAT because he never served in prison. If you think, and then it said, there has never been an eligibility verification form that he has met PAT. If you think we are wrong, we will do one. And so that is what the department did. They said
this isn't necessarily an as-applied challenge, is it?
No, I don't think so. No.
No. So there's that form that, as I understood it, a form that was filed 90 days beforehand, and that if it wasn't contested or a hearing wasn't held to the contrary, then he got it on that 90th day, the PAT.
If the sentencing court determined to agree with the department's consideration that he should be released, then yes, he was released. Yes.
Thank you.
The Department of Corrections did not have discretion under 302.113.2b. 302.113.2b said an inmate shall be released when he has served his term of confinement plus positive adjustment time earned. And under 973.198, it always takes longer. The process takes longer in every single case for an individual to get out. If somebody wanted to use 30 days of positive adjustment time, under the old system, the process began 120 days before his confinement end date. Now it begins 30 days before his confinement end date. And if 90 days goes by, the court might not make a decision whether the person's eligible until after his confinement end date has already come. The person's already out of prison. That's what happened in the example that the warden gives in his brief. A couple other quick points. On the main issue of whether the legislature can retroactively take away the right to earn positive adjustment time, discretion does not burst the bubble of an ex post facto analysis. That was discussed as recently as the Pugh case in 2013. It was mentioned in Garner, all these cases after Morales. Morales, there's a footnote that the warden relies heavily on about affecting opportunities for release. Merely affecting opportunities is not enough. But increasing the sentence is enough. And Morales itself recognized that's what happened in Weaver when the right to earn gain time for good credit was taken away. That's what happened in Lindsay when the state of Washington changed the range of sentences by taking away the floor, the minimum. And that's what happened here. When an individual has the right to earn, an individual may earn 2 days or 1 day for every 2 days of good time. And that's taken away before.
What amount of time did he serve in prison on the 18-month Waukesha County confinement portion of the total term of imprisonment?
What's the total time in prison?
In prison. On that 18-month compartment of that sentence.
I don't know the exact time because there was some jail time that he received credit for.
Well, 6 months. As a condition of probation. But so he got the credit, but that's not the issue. Because to be eligible for PAT, you have to be at that juncture of serving your prison sentence. So on the 18 months, how many days in prison did he serve before he thinks he should have received PAT?
Because you can't do it before you go in prison, right?
That's what the Court of Appeals held, is that you can't get it for your time in jail before prison. It's just in prison.
Did
so.
He serve any days in prison on that Waukesha County case?
Not yeah, yes, jail, but he prison. Would have. I don't know the exact number, Your Honor. I'm sorry, but he would have served some time on it. And then also, the Waukesha case and the Milwaukee case are computed as a single sentence. That's how 302.113 works. So they're merged together.
Well,
the consecutive
respectfully,
sentences.
The confinement portions are merged consecutively. So the Milwaukee County case confinement portion would attach to the 18-month confinement portion of the Waukesha County case. And
yes.
That's why I had an interest here in what exactly you're going after, because part of the Milwaukee County case is 24 plus 36, for which PAT does not apply. Okay? So you're working with that. That attaches, the 24 attaches to the initial 18 months of confinement of the total term of imprisonment for the Waukesha County case, for which he did deserve some credit and received, I think, 281 days or something like that. Having said that, how many days of the 18 months did he serve in actual prison? I'm curious because counsel has enlightened us that there's been an amendment, and now it does not reflect prison time for the Waukesha County case. That's why I'm asking you these questions.
Yeah, that wasn't made part of the record. What counsel said, I believe, is that this happened in July of this past year, so he would have served prison time well before that on the case. So the rest of his sentence.
That he did not receive his opportunity to get credit for PAT time for a third of the time on the 18 months?
Well, it'd have been a third of the time on what's left, because the 18 months and the 24 months are computed as a continuous sentence.
I don't think you can do that. You've got another 24 months in
yes.
jail that's concurrent to the one you're talking about for the crime that occurred,
right.
and you are not going to be getting out on the first one. I think if you've got any time coming, it's on the 2008, and that depends on if I buy the argument it's the date of conviction or the date of sentencing.
Well, the other Milwaukee case was concurrent to any other sentence. That's
okay. There were. If you go back and look, and I have the documents right here, when you end up with them, you end up with the one. For me, it's the date of. They're all convicted on the same date. He committed 7/25/11. Okay, that's concurrent to count three, which is the one committed 8/23/11, where he gets exactly the same sentence, and consecutive to any other, and the any other is the Waukesha County case that he's sentenced on. So I don't see how you can say that he was going to be getting out earlier. I mean, he may get, maybe he's eligible for PAT on the 7/25/11 commission, but he's not going anywhere with it because he's got exactly the same sentence for a commission that occurred 8/10/2011, when there was no PAT.
Any other commission was concurrent to any other sentence. That's the way that one was worded
right.
in the conviction. So it could have been concurrent to the Waukesha County one, and then he'd be able to earn it on the rest of the Milwaukee County conviction.
I think your answer might be the 24 months doesn't change. It just would have started earlier because
yes.
the 18 months would have been reduced.
Well, that's
hence,
the only place
be out
he can
earlier
get PAT.
In the end.
That's the only place he can get PAT is on the. Is
right.
on 18 months.
Counsel, how do you expect, or how would you like this opinion to be written?
The opinion should affirm the Court of Appeals opinion on the main issue about whether you can repeal the right to earn positive adjustment time retroactively. Judge Gundrum's explanation was correct, and it reflects the current state of ex post facto law. Under 302.113 sub 2 sub b, there is a right to release when that right was taken away. That violated the ex post facto clauses, and when the additional 90 days is added to the sentence, that also violated the ex post facto clauses. So it should be affirmed in part, adopting much of.
And for your position is ex post facto is calculated as of the commission or the sentence, or the conviction or the sentence?
Yes, all three are relevant dates. If an individual commits a crime and the penalty is later increased, that's unconstitutional. If the legislature reduces a penalty and induces somebody to plead guilty and be sentenced under a lesser scheme, and then right before the person goes to prison increases the sentence, that also violates the ex post facto clause, as it gets back to the fair notice concept that the warden's counsel addressed as well. So both dates are relevant for ex post facto analysis. Under the 2009 law was gone, or the pre 2009 law was gone when the old sentencing systems were.
The state says that you think that he was comes under 2B, 302.113 2B, but there's nothing in the record that substantiates that. What's your response to that?
Well, in the record are his convictions, which are nonviolent Class H felonies. So as a general rule, Mr. Singh would be eligible for.
Are they labeled Class H felonies?
They were Class H.
Yep.
So they were two. So that fits under 2B. The only way it wouldn't apply is there is a formal process engaged in by the Department of Corrections, and the Warden's Council doesn't tell us that happened and determine him to be ineligible.
Okay.
So, you know, it's
the
difficult
record substantiates your claim that it's a Class H, and there's nothing in the record that substantiates that 304.061BG1 applies.
Correct. There is nothing that. Nothing in the record disproving the exception, I guess, is what it comes down to. So as a matter of the rule, he'd be eligible.
Thank you.
I have another question. I don't quite understand how you want the court to direct the circuit court to issue a writ of habeas corpus. Is that literally what you want?
Yes, Your Honor. It's to the main issue at this point. Mr. Singh is out of prison, so the main issue is to explain the law, recognize that you can't take away the right to early release that was presented in 2009, recognize that 973-198 is unconstitutional because it adds up to 90 days, but then send the case back to the circuit court. Habeas extends beyond release from prison. There are other, you know, it's an equitable remedy. It's typically released from prison, but it can be more than that. Truth in sentencing gives you a term of imprisonment, which is confinement plus extended supervision. Mr. Singh is still in the custody of the Department of Corrections and will be until the extended supervision is over. So the circuit court would have the ability to consider whether other remedies are appropriate in that sentence of imprisonment.
Like what?
Perhaps changing the conditions of extended supervision, perhaps reducing the term of extended supervision. There's no good substitute for having been in prison longer than you should have been in prison, but perhaps reducing the custody by decreasing extended supervision would be some sort of relief for the constitutional violations that occurred.
Is he going to ask for money?
What's it?
Is he going to ask for money for wrongful custody?
I don't think that habeas covers that, Your Honor. I don't know that would be one of the things that habeas would be able to provide. Whether there's some separate action, I don't know. But
well, I understand that, but we're talking about equitable relief.
Yes. So I don't think.
Is he going to ask for money?
I don't know what he plans to do. I don't know what the
scope. Could he ask for money?
I'm not aware of any habeas case where that would be a type of relief. I don't know whether there's some other cause of action for it, but if he was in prison longer than he should have been, that was a constitutional violation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both for very interesting arguments and also very, very good briefs. We're going to take a brief recess now so that these students can leave and some other students can join us. And then we'll be back momentarily for our second case of the day. Thank you.